You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
You're tuned into R1 News at 1. Every weekday from 1 till 2 p.m, our dedicated news team brings you the hard-hitting stories, interviews and culture pieces from across Otepoti, Dunedin. Here are the R1 News at 1 headlines.
This is the R1 News Bulletin for Thursday the 12th of September. I'm Charlie.
And I'm Jonah. In international news, yesterday, US election opponents Donald Trump and Kamala Harris faced off in a televised election debate for the first, and perhaps only, time. RNZ, The Guardian, The Financial Times, and The New York Times report. The two candidates, who had never met before, shook hands and greeted each other cordially, but the debate quickly progressed to fiery disagreements on topics such as abortion and the economy, immigration, and the war in Ukraine. The debate included personal attacks, such as Harris accusing Trump's rallies of being so boring that his supporters were seen leaving early, as well as accusing his inherited wealth. Harris also claimed that the world leaders were laughing at Donald Trump and called him a, quote, disgrace. Trump, in turn, accused the Democrats of turning the judicial system against him, which he claimed stoked his assassination attempt in July. He also accused Harris of being a Marxist, and the pair both exchanged accusations of the other being, quote, weak on national security. Trump also made unfounded claims, including repeating his running mate, J.D. Vance's statement, that Haitian migrants in Ohio were stealing household pets. They're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats, he claimed, sparring with the moderators, attempting to fact-check him. According to preliminary estimates, the debate was watched by 60 million Americans. Although Trump has claimed a victorious debate performance, key election supporters have expressed doubts. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a former third-party candidate who recently endorsed Trump, told Fox News that Harris, quote, clearly won. It is unclear whether another televised debate will take place before the election on November 8th. None is scheduled, and while Harris expressed a willingness for a second debate, Trump told Fox News on Wednesday he would be, quote, less inclined to after yesterday's debate.
In national news, the government has announced more structured literacy for schools. Kate Nicol-Williams of One News reports, the government has just announced that a pilot trial of phonics test will start in 80 schools nationwide before it is fully implemented into our education system in Term 1 next year. Education Minister Erica Stanford told One News, quote, we're really excited to make sure that we're putting in place a phonics check really early on in a child's reading journey so that we can make sure they're on track with their reading and we can intervene when they're not. Stanford also explained that no consistent view on the student progression and literacy nationwide exists at the moment. This tool will also be introduced into Te Reo Māori for students currently learning Māori at a medium level. The phonics check uses words that are made up to ensure that children correctly identify the sound without relying on their recall of how a word looks. Students and staff at Bulcott School were given this tool yesterday to give it a go. Bulcott School has decided to use operational budget funding to introduce a structured literacy approach from 2021. The principal and literacy head teacher did this to ensure that they would be confident using the new literacy structure when it is implemented next year. Principal Rachel Soule said, quote, we started it because we found that our students weren't doing well in their oral literacy at year one. They were arriving at school with very little oral capability, and their reading and sounding out. Our results were going down and down. Implementing structured literacy for us here at Bulcott has been a really positive thing, and we've seen increased results. The funding a primary school will receive to implement the new structure will depend on its roll size. At the lowest end, schools with a roll size up to 50 students will receive $500, and on the highest end, schools with 527 students will receive $5,083. This funding will be used to buy the structure of literacy books, games, and other resources. The Ministry of Education also confirmed that $33 million previously spent on reading recovery and other literacy interventions will be reallocated to fund staffing for this new literacy structure. However, this announcement has come with significant backlash from New Zealand's educational community. The New Zealand's Principal Federation and the New Zealand Educational Institute have called on the government to pause the structured literacy and structured maths curriculum rollout. In a press release yesterday, NZEI and the New Zealand Principals Federation stated that the rapid rate of change means implementation will be ineffective and not lead to the successful outcomes for children that everyone wants. A last-minute amendment to the gang patch policy has put the government under major scrutiny, One News reports. Legal experts across New Zealand have expressed concerns over a last-minute amendment to the government's gang patch legislation. The conversation has reported that a person convicted of publicly displaying gang insignia 3 times in 5 years under the new legislation will also be banned from possessing gang insignia for 5 years. Quote, in essence, it will make it illegal for repeat offenders to live in the same place as gang insignia is displayed, regardless of whether the insignia is theirs or belongs to someone else on the property. Last month, the New Zealand Law Society wrote an open letter to Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith, which heavily criticised the move. It stated, "The Law Society believes this is an incursion into private life, and that is not justified on the basis of the evidence available, and raises Bill of Rights and rule of law concerns. The Society also raised concerns about the potential impacts of other people who live with the offender, stating that the amendment will extend evidence gathering to the entire property, and may lead to closets, underwear drawers, and other private areas that do not belong to the offender being searched." Chris Macklin from the Law Society told Breakfast yesterday that their main concern with this amendment is the legal process behind it. Quote, "The proposal for the amendment has been proposed over a month after the selection committee process concluded. I guess that means it's months, plural, after submissions closed on the bill." He also said that this amendment added a new substantive offence, which gave new search powers to the police. He further stated that this is not the sort of amendment we'd expect to see so late in the process and without public consultation. Macklin also questioned the merits of the amendment. He gave an example of whether this would deter potential offenders from violating this part of the legislation.
In university news, a reminder that the nominations are currently open for the upcoming OUSA exec for 2025. If you're keen to be on next year's student exec, then head to the OUSA main office reception along with two mates to nominate you to get on the ballot. You have until 4:30 p.m. today to get nominated. To find out more about the roles available, duties of the exec, the election process and rules, head to ousa.org.nz. A University of Otago teaching fellow at the School of Physical Education, Sport and Exercise Sciences, Dr. Sebastian J.S. Potgieter, has published a piece in Newsroom on Israel's uncertain place in international sport. The piece comes in the context of a pending decision on whether to expel Israel from international football following a legal review requested by the Palestinian Football Association in May to suspend Israel. As FIFA, which governs football at the global level, postponed the decision until after the 2024 Paris Olympics, the Israeli football team was able to compete there. This Olympics has been Israel's most successful to date, with the team returning home with 1 gold, 5 silver, and 1 bronze medal. The Times of Israel wrote that the athletes, quote, "brushed off threats and boos in Paris," referring to the limited protests at the country's participation in the event. This is in spite of the International Court of Justice recently ruling that Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories was illegal and the country was guilty of discrimination and apartheid, and the Israeli Defense Force's now nearly 12-month bombardment of the Gaza Strip, which has seen over 40,000 Palestinian deaths. Neither the French government nor the Olympic Committee has objected to Israel's participation in the Games. There is precedent of a country being expelled due to racial discrimination policies, with apartheid South Africa being expelled in 1970 for violating the principles of Olympism. Furthermore, FIFA expelled Russia from participating in international football just 2 weeks after its illegal invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Dr. Potgieter joins us shortly to discuss the issue further.
This has been the R1 News Bulletin for Thursday, the 12th of September. Today's bulletin was written and read to you by Jonah Broughton and Charlie Cunningham.
Those were the headlines for today on R1 News at 1. Catch up on previous R1 News wherever you get your podcasts or head to r1.co.nz/news.
Well, today we're joined by Sebastian Potgieter, a University of Otago teaching fellow at the School of Physical Education, Sport and Exercise Science, to discuss his recent piece in Newsroom on Israel's participation in international sport. Thanks very much for joining us today, Sebastian.
Kia ora, thanks for having me.
So I think we'll start off by talking about the pending FIFA decision on whether to expel Israel from international football. Could you give us some background on this and explain what's at stake with this decision?
Yeah, of course. So this decision comes from a request launched by the Palestinian Football Association in May to have Israel expelled from FIFA based on what Palestine was deeming the human rights violations that were taking place at that stage in Gaza. Obviously, Israel launched its offensive on Gaza in October of last year in response to a Hamas attack on Israeli citizens, which killed 1,000-plus people. What's at stake for FIFA really is, and probably the reason it's delayed its decision, and this is perhaps more of a personal opinion, but FIFA will be closely considering who Palestine's allies are, and obviously one of the major allies is the US, which is a major sort of TV audience for FIFA, and that will certainly be something which is factoring into its decision. Perhaps somewhat cynically, one could say that there is, these major sports bodies are fundamentally commercial entities, and that there will be a commercial aspect to FIFA's decision, which I'm sure is one of the reasons it has been delaying its decision so repeatedly. It's delayed it again until October of this year.
And so the major precedent for this decision, which you mentioned throughout your piece, is South Africa being expelled from both FIFA and the International Olympic Committee for 30 years because of its apartheid policies. Do you see a parallel here with Israel's treatment of Palestine?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the parallels are very stark. They've certainly... It's interesting, I think up until fairly recently, South Africans have been a bit reticent to recognize Palestinians' treatment as a form of apartheid, but following the verdict delivered by the International Court of Justice, it certainly seems that what Israel is practicing is undoubtedly a form of apartheid. If we look at, for instance, the racial segregation that's taking place in Palestine, it's not only segregation in terms of separation, there's also a very clear privileging of Israelis over Palestinians to the detriment of Palestinians. If we look, for instance, at some of the major scaffolding of the South African apartheid system, things like the Group Areas Act, things like pass laws, things like homeland policies, all of which were designed to fundamentally deprivilege the South African black population. We're seeing very similar things being done in Palestine at the moment. We have Palestinians who are being forcefully removed from their lands, violently so. Their lands are then being reclassified as Israeli territory, which is completely against international human rights law. Israel has a occupying responsibility as the occupying power. One of those is it cannot move its own citizens into the territories that it has occupied. It has repeatedly done so, continues to do so. Those territories then get used to serve Israeli citizens through things like occupying infrastructure, occupying natural resources, which are being used to benefit Israeli citizens and not being given to Palestinian citizens. So Palestinians who then get basically expelled from their own lands, and if we look at, for instance, the West Bank, which is divided into three sections, Palestinians have been sort of isolated to one very overcrowded section. They now need permits to re-enter other areas of the West Bank, which are being controlled and occupied by Israel. So very similar sorts of scaffolding compared to the South African apartheid system that have been implemented very clearly in Palestine at the moment and the occupied Palestinian territories.
And having said that and giving context to this, especially mentioning the recent decisions of the International Court of Justice, could those findings by the court be used to justify these claims to expel Israel from international sport?
Absolutely, yeah. I think if basically what the International Criminal Justice Court found was that Israel was breaching human rights laws, and if that isn't grounds for expulsion from sport, I'm not too sure what is. If we see, for instance, how there's Israel has kind of asserted its rule over Palestine by doing things like importing its own sporting infrastructure into the occupied territories, that is completely against international law. They're simply not allowed to do that. They're violating their responsibilities as an occupying power. So absolutely, it seems, and this is one of the sort of strange features of the situation, why Israel hasn't been expelled, because there is just so much evidence to suggest that they should be. There's very little. There's always complexity and there's always debate, but it certainly seems that if we also consider the precedent of what's been done in the past with apartheid South Africa, it certainly seems like there are overwhelming grounds for Israel's expulsion from international sports.
And something that we hear time and time again around topics like this, especially in apartheid South Africa, is something like keep politics out of sport. Mm. And people saying, surely the Israeli football team has nothing to do with the Israeli military and government. How would you respond to people that have this kind of thinking?
Yeah. I mean, this is such a frequent thing that we hear, this idea that somehow sport is apolitical or sport is autonomous from politics. But sport is inherently political. You cannot physically separate sport from politics. Sports are carriers of things like value systems. They are carriers of political ideologies. They carry the norms and the values of the places that they emanate from. So sport is always inherently political. So it's impossible to distinguish sport from politics. And if we look at, for instance, I've raised this earlier, but one of the ways in which Israel has asserted its rule over Palestine is by doing things like importing its own sporting systems and using Palestinian facilities. And FIFA has actually been called out for the fact that it sanctioned Israeli club matches on Palestinian lands, which had been illegally obtained. So sport and politics can never really be seen as separate. And again, there are a lot of sort of historical precedents for this. If we look back at apartheid South Africa, when the All Blacks continued to play rugby with South Africa, rugby was the sport most closely aligned with white nationalism in South Africa, and continuing rugby relations with South Africa actually stalled any meaningful sort of boycott of sport, which lessened pressure, because basically South Africa's white populations felt that, well, if New Zealand is still willing to play rugby with South Africa, and you know, New Zealand being South Africa's most valued rival, basically that just sort of gives this illusion of business as usual. It gives the feeling that the current system is sustainable and that it can go on, and that perhaps the criticisms are not what they seem to be. So it's impossible to separate sport and politics in this respect. And it's interesting, if we look at, for instance, the Israeli situation, we know that conscription is mandatory in Israel. If you're an Israeli male or an Israeli female, you have to enter the military. We've also seen on social media a lot of Israeli athletes posting sort of quite vitriolic content against Gaza and against Hamas, saying things like, we'll eviscerate Gaza or we'll eviscerate Hamas. So sport is very entangled with politics in this situation, and Israel has for very long had a policy of, they are willing to compete against anyone. They are willing to play sport against anyone, regardless of racial differences, ethnic differences, ideological, political, religious differences. And what that does is it creates the illusion on a sort of grand scale of the Israeli state as an inclusive entity, as an entity which is not discriminatory through, for instance, how they are willing to play sport with just about anyone. So it's very sort of intricately interwoven, the relationship between sport and politics. And like I've said, there are a lot of historical precedents around this, particularly in the South African context. So it's physically impossible to separate sport and politics. That's sort of us in the critical sports studies side of things see those two things as very closely connected with one another.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today. I think we have to wind up things now, but it was such a fascinating chat and I really learned a lot from it. So thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you very much. And we've got more news coming up for you, but first we have Loving You by Hako.
Welcome back to the R1 News at 1. My name is Jemima. I'm the news producer, and I am taking over the Thursday news show just for a little bit because we have the debut of a very special segment. I'll let the airwaves talk for themselves.
DPAG's late breakfast host, Alex Lister, joins the R1 News to talk about the latest art gallery news in Aotearoa. You can tune into the DPAG late breakfast show at 11 a.m. on Saturdays on Radio 1 91 FM.
Kia ora, Alex.
Kia ora, Jemima. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you going?
Good, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's so lovely to have you on talking about what's going on in Aotearoa's art scene.
Yeah,
it's at the moment.
It's an exciting space, I'll tell you what. There's a lot going on. And I should have done a lot more prep for this, but it is the debut. So I thought we'd just talk about, obviously, the DPAG today. And then we could talk about other galleries that people might not know about. There's in the city as well.
Yeah.
So the exhibitions haven't really changed too much over the past month. There is a really good one that I recommend people go see. It's Marjorie Blackman's Weaving Life. Have you been to this exhibition before?
I haven't yet.
Oh, no. Well, I'm telling you, you're missing out. You need to head on down to that because Marjorie Blackman she's still alive. She's very old, though. She was a weaver, and not anymore, she's retired. But she's got like all these weavings that she's done. They're all incredible. I wish that somehow on radio we could show pictures because they are, it's hard to describe. But that's the main exhibition down at the DPAG at the moment, which is really nice. I went and saw that a couple of weeks ago, and I wouldn't say it was life-changing, but I would say it was life-altering. There's also another exhibition at the moment called Chaptered, which has got a bunch of different New Zealand artists, including Ralph Hotore at the moment. It's just about like different montages and collage. That's the one. A lot of collage artwork that's there at the moment, and that's pretty much it. When you go to the DPAG, there's always that big installation on the side wall. And for a while, it was the these reflective squares.
Yes.
They've been replaced.
Whoa.
So they're gone now, unfortunately. RIP to a real one. But it's Kerry Polinus with Black O. So this is the big wall project, and it's going to be lasting until early 2025. And it's just, not just, but there's a bunch of black O's on the wall, which are all very geometric, and if you stand at different angles then they look different. So that's what's happening at the DPAG at the moment. Nothing out of the ordinary for them. They're just exceptional as always. And then there's a bunch of other art galleries as well, which hasn't been touched on my show at the least, but a lot of ones that people don't know about. So there's things like the Artist Room, Bellamy's Gallery, the Blue Oyster Gallery, which is down on Dowling Street.
Love Blue Oyster.
They're very cool. I love Blue Oyster. The exhibition's out the gate. Olga Gallery as well, Gallery De Novo, Gallery on Blueskin, which is a little bit of a hike if people wanted to go out there. Hocken Gallery, which is the Hocken's Collections, so that's the library down by Forsyth Bar. So that's got a bunch of art and other I guess you could say artifacts as well. Do you think they're called artifacts because they're art?
They've got to be. There can only be. Is not the human experience? Isn't life art?
Does life imitate art, or does art imitate life?
We're asking the big questions here.
We are, and that's a lot to get into with one segment, but we can always plan for next time. And there's another one that I think has been slept on. It's on Castle Street as well, which is even crazier, but it's called Koru. And it's predominantly shows work by Māori artists and a Māori theme. And there's notable local Ngāi Tahu artists such as Phyllis Smith, James York, and Hine Forsyth as well. It's like a huge range. There's like ceramics, weaving, carving, stone, Ponamu, all those things. And that's just a few little insights into the different galleries that are in Dunedin. I think going forward, I will attempt to go to more of these galleries and actually do like a proper insight. It's just been a bit busy recently, so haven't been able to actually get out and about. But the winds are changing in that regard, so I think that will be It'll be good. And that's probably all I've got for you, to be honest. Otherwise, I'm just going to have no content for my own show.
Give me away all the secrets. Yeah. This is just a little teaser to hear more about everything. You'll have to tune into the DPAG Late Breakfast at 11 a.m. on Saturday mornings.
Yep. Yep. And it goes to 1, and it's always a good time. Yeah, nothing else to really say other than that. Anything else you want to discuss? Should we go on to that? Did you watch the debate yesterday?
We did touch on the debate in the news today. I personally haven't watched it.
Have you ever seen a dumpster fire?
I've seen a few, when you use that comparison.
That's probably the best way to describe it. So if you want to see one of those but not feel the heat, then that's how I do it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you for the wrap-up on all the arts news, all the art gallery spaces. That's a beautiful way to be spending your time this weekend, getting out to galleries and seeing beautiful local artists creating beautiful things.
I think it's pretty good. And if you see me out there as well, I'm pretty distinctive. So if you see me, hit Count for a Yarn, tell me about other art stuff as well. And I hope to learn more about it, get culturally enriched, and let's do an art space even more so.
Cool. Thank you so much for joining us, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
This is the R1 News at 1. We'll be back very soon with Film Review, where Jonah will be talking about India Song, the film shown at the Dunedin Film Society's screening last night. But first up, before that, we've got Your Essay by Alec. Keep it locked.
Welcome back to R1 News at 1. We have another debut of another segment. My co-host Jonah, who you've all heard every week, every Thursday, he's going to give us a film review of Indian Song. How did you find it last night?
Kia ora, guys. Yeah, so you're going to see a new side of me in this segment. I'll be exploring my film bro side. So last night the Dunedin Film Society screened this film, India Song, directed by Marguerite Duras, which was a 1975 quite experimental, surreal film about the French the wife of the French ambassador to British India's various escapades with lots of different men. And it was definitely an interesting experience. There were quite a few walkouts, definitely not for everyone. Me personally, I'd give it maybe 2 out of 5 stars. It wasn't my cup of tea. I'm quite, I like a entertaining, quite simple, I'm quite a simple-minded guy. I like a very linear plot, clear dialogue, whereas this was just very dreamlike. It was very fever dreamlike, actually, because of the tropical setting. It really, you could feel the heat and smell the incense, and just kind of, it was just a very sweaty, hot, tropical-like experience. All the dialogue happened off-screen, so you weren't really sure who was talking when, what was really going on. There was a 2-minute-long close-up shot of a woman's naked breast, which was quite uncomfortable to experience that in the lecture theatre. If you don't know, the Dunedin Film Society screens in the Castle One Lecture Theatre here at the uni. But, yeah, no, it was definitely an experience. Don't know if you're into really, really wacky stuff, might be up your alley, but don't know. Yeah,
sounds like a very interesting movie.
Mm-hmm.
The way you were describing to us before doesn't really sound like my cup of tea either.
What is your cup of tea, Charlie? What kind of movies?
Just pretty basic. I like to rewatch movies.
Yeah,
Don't really get out there with the movies.
Are you a Tarantino bro?
I've actually, it's a little bit embarrassing to me on here, but I've actually never watched one of his movies.
Really?
I know.
Yeah.
Please don't cancel me.
I'm sure no one will cancel you, unless we have any diehard Tarantino fans on the show tonight. But yeah, no, we'll definitely keep this segment going, hopefully with a bit more structure, and I'll flesh it out a bit more. But we'll be back next week with the Dunedin Film Society screening. Then,
yeah, and I'm sure as every other viewer is on the edge of my seat for next week's film review. But anyway, thank you guys for tuning in for our R1 News show today. Every Thursday, you can catch us. I'm Charlie,
and I'm Jonah,
and thank you very much for listening.
You've been listening to R1 News at 1 here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. The R1 News is uploaded daily wherever you get your podcasts. Or head to r1.co.nz/news to get yourself all caught up. Additionally, you can follow R1 News NZ to keep up to date with all our newsworthy happenings.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.